Well, as you're probably aware, one of the main problems that is facing or confronting our country right now has to do with money. We are, as a nation, about $36 or $37 trillion in debt. That's hard to even get your mind around. The government borrows a lot of money every year just to keep functioning. In fact, I'm told that we pay more in interest now than what we do for our national defense. It's pretty amazing how much money we're paying every day just to keep operating. And much of the spending, much of that money that goes out, is to take care of poor people. People who live in poverty, people who are homeless, people who are jobless, people who have virtually no other means of support, the government supports them. Our country has large and generous programs for the poor. And frankly, one of the reasons that our country is going broke is because of these generous programs for the poor. Well, Israel also had programs for the poor. And today we're looking at some of these programs or some of these laws that God instituted to take care of poor people. People who often did not have the same financial resources as others. He mentions in particular the Levites, the orphans, the widows, and strangers. The Bible mentions care for the poor quite frequently, both the Old Testament and New Testament. Jesus, of course, dealt with the poor from time to time. We know that we are to remember the poor and their needs, and so we have obligations. We should be sensitive to the needy and the poor among us. Of course, we do have today something that the Israelites didn't have, which was a full-blown, robust government program, kind of a net to catch those who are in poverty. Sometimes the government gets involved in things that it shouldn't, but one of the things that they do is to provide sort of a safety net for the poor. And we might think, well, since the government does everything for the poor, the church doesn't have to. Well, there are responsibilities that we have as individual Christians, Christian families, and as a Christian church as well. We'll be talking a little bit about that. I've titled this message, Money Matters, because many of the things that these rules pertain to money. Tithing, helping people in need, giving out loans if we ought to require the repayment of the loan, helping the poor, the widow, the orphan. So it's money matters. And so today we'll see what Moses says here regarding some issues of finances, some money matters. First of all, he says, tithe of your yearly increase. Notice chapter 14, verse 22. You shall surely tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year, and then eat before the Lord in the place where he chooses to make his name known, verses 22 and 23. And really going through 26 is the idea of this tithe that is to be brought to the central altar. God expected Israel to bring the tithe. Of course, that's 10% of their earning, and particularly from the land. These would be primarily agricultural people. They're farmers. And so they were to gather when they harvested the land, harvested their crops. They were to bring a tithe of it, 10%, to the central altar. That would be where the tabernacle was set up. And so things like grain and oil and wine and their livestock, the firstborn of the livestock, which belonged to the Lord, that they were supposed to sacrifice. They were supposed to bring that 10% of their income or their produce off the land to the central altar. And notice verse 23, there you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chose to make his name abide. The tithe of the grain and your new wine and oil, the firstborn of your herds, your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. So they brought these items, these materials, to the Lord there, and they were to have a sacrificial meal. Now, we know in the sacrifice, they didn't necessarily burn up the entire animal. They burned up usually parts of the animal, and then the rest of the animal and their grain and wine and various materials, they could actually enjoy eating. They would have a celebratory lunch or kind of a picnic or a banquet before the Lord and with the Levite and the poor and the sojourner and enjoy that part of it. Somebody said the picture is of the Lord as host inviting his people to his house to enjoy how richly he has blessed them. At the end of verse 23, it says the purpose for this, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. In other words, they are to remember that God had provided all these things and that God is requiring a partial sacrifice of the increase of their land to show that they are relying upon the Lord. And then he goes on to verses 24 through 26 to say that if the journey is too long, that is, if they're living far away from the central altar, they could exchange some of their materials for money. They could sell these materials that normally they would bring to the central altar. They would exchange them for money, get the money, take the money to the central altar, and there buy the materials that would be necessary for the sacrifice. And so we have in the New Testament the situation where you would exchange your money. Remember, Jesus talked about the money changers? So they would come from the fields or come from the country round about. They would go to the temple. They would exchange their money. Then they would buy the materials necessary for the sacrifice and for this meal. And so that had become, at the time of Jesus, corrupted to the extent that Jesus overthrew the money-changing tables and drove those people out of there. But there was a purpose for the money changers. There was a purpose for this because they could do this process where they didn't have to herd all their animals and take all their, you know, carts and loads of stuff with them. They could just exchange it all for money and then come to the place and do the sacrifice then. And notice at the end of verse 26, you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep or wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires. You shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. So this is the expectation that they would bring these things to the Lord, be part of the sacrifice, and rejoice. They would have this banquet or this ceremonial meal, and it would be a time not only of sacrifice for their sins, but also a time of enjoying the tithe. They would, instead of, you know, giving away all that 10%, they would eat part of it. Part of it would go for the sacrifice, part of it would go for the Levites, but they would enjoy a sacrificial meal together. Now, as we read verse 26, you might stumble a little bit over this idea. Spend your money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, that would be, you know, part of the sacrifice, for wine or similar drink. It might say strong drink. So wine or strong drink. And we might think, we don't use wine or strong drink. If they were able to do this in the Old Testament, it seems like the Old Testament Israelite had the allowance to drink wine or strong drink. Why don't we get to do that? Perhaps we as New Testament Christians should be able to have wine or strong drink. Well, I thought I'd take a moment or two to address that, because clearly wine or strong drink is described here in positive terms. So we certainly can't say that the Bible is uniformly against the drinking of alcohol in every situation. Here is a situation in which Moses himself says, go ahead and buy and drink this stuff. So what do we think about it? Well, a couple of things. First of all, Old Testament believers could buy and drink wine and fermented alcohol. Wine, of course, is made of grapes. It was usually mildly intoxicating. Strong drink or other kinds of drink here, the word here is literally fermented alcohol. So fermentation, we typically think of fermented alcoholic drink as beer. That's probably what he's talking about here. Not necessarily strong in the sense of more alcoholic content, but it's just fermented, some sort of a fermented drink. So clearly the text does allow the drinking of alcoholic beverages for the Israelites in this case. And so we might think that then that gives us the allowance to do it as well. But I would urge caution, a great deal of caution, when it comes to how we deal with the issue of alcohol. The alcoholic beverages that are in view here were considerably different than what is commonly available to us today. The alcoholic content in wine and fermented drink would be relatively low. In fact, a couple of indications in the Bible that you would have to drink pretty much all day long to consume enough alcoholic content to be drunk by the end of the day. It was the content of the alcohol was so little that it would take a lot of drinking to get drunk. You may remember that the process of distilling was not invented or not discovered until several centuries after the time of Christ. So today, people can make very strong alcohol, whatever it is, 100 proof, I don't know the proof, I don't know that system at all, but they can distill alcohol and make very, very high degrees of alcohol through distilling, but that process was not known as far as the Middle East, ancient Near East at this time. So they didn't distill alcohol, it was all through natural fermentation, which led to a fairly low alcoholic content. So, also in the ancient world, alcohol was beneficial in that it killed germs and parasites. Now, they didn't understand the germ theory of disease at that time, I don't think, but they did know that alcohol purified and disinfected. You may remember the parable that Jesus gave of the Good Samaritan. The guy was beat up at the side of the road, and what did the guy do to help him? Poured in oil and wine, because wine disinfects. And they knew that if you were uncertain about the water, you could pour in a little wine, and the alcoholic content of that wine would kill the diseases or kill the parasites, kill the germs that were in there. I don't think that they really understood about germs, but they knew that wine, the alcoholic content in wine, would purify. So that was a good use for that. The Bible also, we know, contains warnings about the dangers of alcohol. Although here the alcohol is used in a positive sense, still there are many passages in the Old Testament that warn us about that. For example, Proverbs 20, verse 1, "Wine is a mocker, strong drink is raging, and whosoever is deceived thereby is not wise." And speaking of wisdom, modern science has shown that even a little bit of alcohol has a negative effect. It starts affecting your judgment almost immediately. In fact, I've seen people recently say, just from a secular point of view, just a pure scientific point of view, it's best not to drink alcohol because of the negative effects that it has. So whether we're speaking the threat or the warnings about the dangers of alcohol or purely from a scientific point of view, staying away from it is the best idea. What I've usually urged people to do, as far as my advice regarding alcohol, is simply avoid it, simply abstain from it. There's no particular reason that we these days have to drink or should drink alcohol. There's nothing necessarily beneficial from it or associated with it. There are many negative things, as we know these days, associated with alcohol. Much of the crime, much of the accidents, much of the problems and chaos that we have in our world today is due to people drinking alcohol. And so I think it's a wise thing for us to do as New Testament Christians, simply to avoid it. Now, I think there may be times when we would use alcohol medicinally. I've been struggling with a cold over the last few days, and I have some of this, you know, what Dayquil is, NyQuil, Dayquil. I don't know what percentage of alcohol that is, but when you drink it, you feel the alcohol. You notice that there may be a beneficial aspect to using alcohol medicinally. I think my wife tells a story that when she was a girl, she had a bad cold, and the doctor recommended giving her some whiskey. And that's what they did. And they're not drinkers. I forget exactly where they got a hold of the whiskey. They might have convinced somebody else to go to the liquor store to get them a bottle of whiskey. We can use it medicinally. We can use it for other purposes. But I would suggest my strong indication, my strong advice would be simply avoid alcohol. Now, that's one kind of controversial topic that comes up here. What about the other somewhat controversial topic, tithing? Verse 22, "You shall surely tithe of all the increase of your grain and the fields that it produces year by year." So are we under obligation as New Testament believers to tithe, that is to give 10% of our income to the Lord? Well, Jesus certainly commended tithing. It seems like Jesus himself tithed. But, of course, Jesus is operating under the Old Testament system. He's operating still under the law. The law was not put out of operation until Jesus' death and resurrection. So we could look in the New Testament for the teaching regarding giving the tithe, and we simply don't find it. There's no New Testament teaching. Even when Paul is dealing with the issue of money and support of ministries financially, he does not bring up the issue of tithing. And so we really don't find a New Testament command that pertains to New Testament believers that it's incumbent or obligated. It's an obligation that we have to tithe. When discussing our financial obligations to the church, the New Testament tells us to give cheerfully, regularly, sacrificially, and proportionately. The Bible says, "Let every man determine in his own heart how much he's going to give out of how the Lord has blessed him." But it doesn't require a tithe. My understanding is that we determine in our heart what is the proper amount to give, and we give cheerfully, we give regularly, sacrificially, and proportionately. As a general rule, however, when thinking about what would be the proper amount to give, I think the tithe or more is a proper amount to give. So I would say we're not obligated, we're not under that command to tithe as New Testament Christians, but I do see that pattern in the Old Testament and elsewhere, that Jesus commends tithing. The Old Testament certainly commends tithing. We find examples of tithing. although the Old Testament saint was required to give much more than the tithe, but still we do see this tithe as kind of a pattern that I think is wise for us to emulate. I think it's a good pattern to follow that you know, we as New Testament believers actually have more benefits and more privileges. And so I think the tithe is a good place to start. I think giving more than the tithe is certainly a wonderful thing to do as well. I found that failure to support the ministry of your church financially is really a spiritual problem, much more than a financial problem. Even people in poverty can prioritize their lives and their finances aright so that they can participate in the maintenance and the offerings of the church. So if a person fails to give or just does not give, it's really a priority issue. It's a heart issue, not so much a financial one. Well, we may not be obligated to tithe like the Old Testament saints were, but I think giving a tithe is certainly a good pattern to follow. It's a good biblical practice. Let's go on to look at, secondly, then, tithe every third year for the Levites and the destitute. As we go on, verse 27, "You shall not forsake the Levite who is within your gates, for he has no part nor inheritance with you. At the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates. And the Levite, because he has no portion nor inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates may come and eat and be satisfied that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do." Okay, so another tithe, in addition to the yearly tithe of their produce, is this third year tithe. Every third year they're to bring a specific tithe for the maintenance of the Levite and the destitute. He mentions, in fact, three particular categories of people. The Levite, of course, they were the sons of Aaron. They were the religious workers. They were the people who worked in the tabernacle and later in the temple. And they were scattered throughout all Israel. They had certain cities that were dedicated to the Levites, and then the Levites might live anywhere. And they'd be the teachers of the law. They would do various religious functions. But because they were Levites, they didn't have property like everybody else did. All the other families of the Jews, all the other Hebrew families, had properties, fields and things that they could work and get the increase from. But the Levites, they could have a house in the town, usually inside the city gates, and they had the access to pasture for some of their animals around the town. But the Levites themselves did not own property, not in the sense of fields, to make an income. So the Levites were dependent upon the rest of Israel. Everybody else had to contribute to sustain the Levites, and the Levites were to be the religious leaders, the teachers, the temple and tabernacle workers. So they were sustained by the giving of others. Interestingly, the Bible says that the Levites had to tithe on what they received. So everybody was tithing. So that's one group of people who did not have a normal income or did not have the financial resources that most everybody else had. Then he talks about the stranger or the sojourner, not strange in the sense of odd, but a non-Israelite, a Gentile, maybe somebody from Moab or somebody from Edom or even an Egyptian or an Amorite or somebody like that, who for whatever reason was living among Israel. These people might be servants, they might be even slaves, who knows, just journeying, they're sojourners, so they're living as resident aliens among the Israelites. And these people typically, because they're maybe servants or they don't own any property, they didn't have a regular source of income. Some of these resources were to be given to them. And then orphans and widows. Of course, these would be among the poorest people in the land. Children without parents and women without husbands often lived in poverty. There's an example of that, of course, in the Old Testament with Ruth and Naomi. Two widows, what were they going to do? They were essentially forced just to glean because they had nothing. So these people typically would be very poor people. And so the tithe of the third year was the program to help the most destitute of the land. And this material was to be collected locally. It says bring it into the storehouse in your cities, not to the main altar, not to the place where the tabernacle was set up, but probably every major city would have a storehouse, and these things were to be brought into the storehouse. So everybody then, especially when the nation prospers, because everybody's bringing the tithe, the more prosperous the entire nation was, the more tithe the materials would come in, and the more prosperous the Levite and the widow and the orphan and the sojourner would be, because they would get a greater amount, because the whole amount was greater that people were bringing in. Those people on the margins of society would be taken care of. The poor, the destitute would have something for them. And notice at the end of verse 29, the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand which you do. So if you do this, God is going to bless you. This is not only going to bless the poor, it's going to bless you. God is going to provide for you if you provide for the poor. All right. So how do we apply these principles today? What would be the parallel in our world today? Well, we don't have Levites today. We're not operating under the Old Testament system. But who are the religious workers? Who are the people who attend to the things of God? Well, people like me, pastors. And just like Israel as a nation was to provide for the Levites, well, the Bible says that the church is supposed to provide for its pastor, and that's what we do here. The people of our church provide very well for us, and I'm very satisfied and thankful for how the people of the church provide for me and my family. What about the destitute? What about those living in poverty? What about the sojourner, the stranger? What about the orphan and the widow? What is our obligation to them? Do we simply say, well, the government takes care of them? We don't need to do anything for the poor because we just turn them over to the government. Well, the government does have a lot of programs and things for the poor, and often the poor people do make use of these government programs, but there may be people that we can help. Firstly, the church's main obligation is toward those who are part of the church. Just like these rules and regulations, these stipulations are for Israel, the fellow Jews, the neighbors, the people who are part of the same covenant, these are the responsibilities toward fellow Jews. Well, for us, when we think about our obligations toward the poor, our primary obligation is for those within the church, those who have financial needs, who are part of us, who are part of our same group, part of our same body of Christ. And so you may remember in Acts chapter 6, when they developed the office of deacon, the issue was that some people were being neglected in the daily distribution of food. At the very beginning of the church, when it first began, there was a food distribution, and some people were complaining because they weren't getting any, or they weren't getting a share of it. And so they developed the office of deacons to take care of that, to provide for the poor, specifically the poor widows in that group of people. And so it was not that the church took care of everybody's needs. It was not that the church was going to solve all of society's problems, but they would provide for the needs of the people who were part of that group, part of the church. And today, of course, we have a deacon's fund. As you all know, we collect the deacon's fund after we observe the Lord's Supper. And we have some money set aside for the needs of people within our church. And you don't necessarily have to be in poverty for that. But if there's a need and the church can help you out, we're more than willing to help people out. And we give toward that. You know, people in the church give toward that need. And we want to have those monies available to help people who, you know, they have needs. And it's a good thing that we can do that. The church usually steps in when the family either can't or won't. So you know the Bible talks about the fact that a family, particularly Christian families, ought to take care of their own. If a man refuses to work, the Bible says he's worse than an infidel, worse than an unbeliever. A man's primary responsibility is to his own family. But if you've got a person who's part of the church and in need, and either like a widow, what Paul says is a widow indeed, who does not have any family support, well, then the church could take the person on to support that lady. Or if there is some other situation where the family simply does not help or cannot help, well, then the church could help in that situation as well. But generally speaking, it's the family's responsibility to take care of its own widows. Now, orphans are different, of course, because orphans don't have a family. And so the church would be even more responsible to help orphans in need. So what about then the stranger or the sojourner? What about this resident alien person? Today the parallel probably would be the immigrant. And we all know that there's lots of news these days about immigration, and there's lots of people who are very concerned about the immigrants coming into our nation. And so what would we do if we had immigrants? Well, of course, we would be concerned about the legality of their immigration. I think we as law-abiding citizens would say, well, we We appreciate legal immigration, but if it's illegal immigration, that's a different thing. Legal immigration is fine. I mean, all of us, I think, come from families who immigrated, almost all of us immigrated to this place. You know, our families did many generations ago. And America is a land of immigrants. And so legal immigration is fine. Illegal immigration, of course, is illegal. They came illegally. They're living here illegally. According to our law, they should be deported. So we can be charitable. We can be kind. We can be sensitive to the needs of anybody. But still, we would not, as some churches do, kind of shield or hide immigrants. We would be in favor of deporting illegal immigrants. We would say, you need to leave, and then if you can come back legally, come back legally. So we can't use portions like this saying that we have to be sensitive to the needs of the sojourner, the immigrant, or the resident alien. Oh, they had to do that in the Old Testament, so now we just have to break open our borders and let everybody come in here. No, we still have to recognize our borders. We still have to recognize the rule of law, that there are certain legal ways and illegal ways that we need to deal with. Yeah, we can be charitable, we can be welcoming and warm to immigrants, but we also have to follow the rule of law. So we should try to show compassion toward the destitute, and particularly, I think, toward church members who have financial needs. Let's go on to chapter 15 then, where he talks about the release debts every 7 years. In this section, Moses is addressing the possibility that an Israelite gets into financial trouble and has to take out a loan from a fellow Israelite. The principles here would help the troubled Israelite get back out of debt and get on their feet financially. So notice he says the possibility here. At the end of every 7 years, you shall grant a release of debts, and this is the form of the release. Every creditor, that's the person who lends, every creditor who has lent anything to his neighbor shall release it. He shall not require it of his neighbor or his brother, because it is called the Lord's release. So what happened here is the guy gets into trouble, he gets into debt, or he has problems, he needs to get a loan from a fellow Jew. And the fellow Jew gives the guy a loan, but he's only supposed to keep that loan out for 6 years. The seventh year it's supposed to be released. So the idea would be you have 6 years to pay back this loan, and hopefully you can pay it back in 6 years. But if you can't pay it back in 6 years, then whatever is remaining at the end of the 6 years, we're just going to cancel. We're just going to release it. We're not going to require it. It'd be like if you take out a loan for a car for, I mean, today you can get loans, I don't know how long, 7 years. Let's say you pay off your loan for 6 years, but it's not fully paid off. Well, then the obligation from a fellow Jew is just drop it. You don't have to pay the rest of it. So the rest of what's remaining of the loan would almost be like a gift. And so he says here that if this happens, even if the seventh year is coming up, the year of release, you still should make the loan. Let's say you only have 1 year left until the seventh year, the sabbatical year. Somebody might say, well, I don't want to take out that. I don't want to give a loan. I don't want to loan out money because it's only going to be a year and then I have to release the rest of the debt. So I don't want to do that because it would be like handing out free money. The Jews could not charge interest, but they could take out loans. They could give a loan to somebody. And the idea would be that they should pay it off. But at the end of every 7 years, it was to be released, even if money was still owed. And the only exception would be verse 3, of a foreigner you may require it, but you shall give up your claim to that which is owed by your brother. So a foreigner, you know, the Moabites, the Edomites, the Egyptians, if they need a loan and you loan out money to them, they have to repay the whole thing. The seven-year sabbatical does not apply to them. But a fellow Hebrew, a fellow Jew, you have to release it at the end of the 7 years. Now Moses foresees the time in verse 4, except that where there be no poor among you, for the Lord will greatly bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving to you to possess as an inheritance. So there may be a possibility that they would be so prosperous if they're obedient to the Lord, God could prosper them so much that nobody is poor. Nobody needs a loan. And that would happen if they follow verse 5. Only if you carefully obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe with care all these commandments which I command you today. The Lord will greatly bless you. There'll be no need for putting out loans and worrying about that stuff because people will be so prosperous that there would be no need for that. And that would happen in verse 6. Here's what else would happen in verse 6. The Lord your God will bless you just as he promised you. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. You shall reign over many nations. They shall not reign over you. If you simply obey the voice of the Lord, fulfill his commands, you'll be prosperous. You'll be the creditor, not the lender, if you obey the voice of the Lord. However, verse 7, if there is among you a poor man, so are they really going to fully obey the voice of the Lord? Are they going to be so obedient that they're so prosperous that there'll be no poor? No, probably not. If there is a poor man among you, of your brethren, within the gates of your land, which the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart nor shut your hand from your poor brother. So Moses urges them, if there are poor people, not to, as he says here, harden your heart or shut your hand to your poor brother. In theory, maybe you'll be so prosperous that there'll be no poor, but in reality, there probably will be. And note the connection between a hard heart and a closed hand. A hard-hearted person is greedy and materialistic and does not want to help his fellow Jew. He has a hard heart, he has a closed hand. The lack of giving, the lack of generosity is not just external. The hand is the heart. It's the greedy heart. It's that heart that's not devoted to the Lord that is not generous. And so he says in verse 8, you shall open your hands wide to him and willingly lend him sufficient for his need, whatever he needs. Open your hand. Somebody said, granted the existence of the poor, the attitude toward them must be one of softness of heart and openness of hand. I like that expression, softness of heart and openness of hand. And as I was thinking about that, there's a person who came to my mind, somebody who has been very generous and very soft-hearted, and sadly he's no longer around, Vern Yonke. Some of you remember Vern. And Vern was almost exactly that, soft-hearted and generous. I can't tell you how many times I'd be sitting in my office in some afternoon, and Vern would drop by, and he'd want to, you know, chew the fat for a little while. And so we'd sit and talk for 10 or 15 minutes, and then he'd say, now, Pastor, why don't you come out to the car with me? I've got something for you. Okay, what's going on? So I'd go out to the car, and he'd have a bag of groceries. He'd have a sack of potatoes. He'd have a bunch of cheese. He'd have, at one point, he had a whole bunch of corn on the cob and stuff out of his freezer. You know, this meat was 2 years old, and he had gotten it somewhere along the line. And here, why don't you have this steak, or here's a roast, or whatever. We ate well when Vern Yonke was every 6 months or so, he'd drop by with a bunch of groceries. And so we miss Vern. He was very generous. But a soft heart, you would not find a soft, he was kind of gruff sometimes, but when you got to know him, he was a soft-hearted guy and would give you the shirt off his back. And so everybody ought to be that way. Everybody ought to be generous. Everybody ought to be open-handed, especially when we see the needs of others. And so verse 9, even if the seventh year is coming up, beware lest there be a wicked thought in your heart saying, the seventh year, the year of release, is at hand, and your eye be evil against your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cries out to the Lord against you, and it becomes a sin among you. So it might be that a guy needs a loan, he needs a gift, he needs some financial aid, and yet you think, well, I don't want to give him anything because if he doesn't pay off the loan, then I have to forgive the whole thing because the seventh year is right around the corner. And so Moses says here, don't do that. Give generously even if the seventh year is near. Even if you are not going to be repaid, they should still give the loan. In fact, they ought to think of this as a gift, okay? Granted, the seventh year is coming up, and maybe you won't be able to pay it off, but that's okay. I don't care. The Lord has been generous to me. I want to be generous to you. And a way of showing open-handed generosity is by lending out the money, even when you think that it probably won't be repaid, at least part of it. Somebody said, let the money fall from your hand to where it can aid a brother in need. I'm reminded of when Boaz said to the workers in the field, let drop handfuls of purpose. You remember that? Just drop some grain out there for Ruth when she is gleaning. Just drop some out there for her to pick up. And so that's kind of the same idea. Be open-handed. Let money drop out of your hand for your needy brethren. Verse 10, You shall surely give to him, and your heart should not be grieved when you give him, because for this thing the Lord your God will bless you in your works and in all which you put your hand to do. So don't grieve having to be generous toward your needy brethren. Give to the Lord because God has blessed you. Now again, verse 11, the poor will never cease from the land. Theoretically, it's possible if you're so obedient to the Lord that everybody's going to prosper and there'll be no poor people. That's a possibility. But in reality, verse 11, the poor will never cease from the land. Therefore, I command you, saying, you shall open your hand wide to your brother, to your poor and needy in your land. Note the emphasis here on your brother, your poor, your needy in your land. So again, there's a distinction here between the Israelites and the non-Israelites. This was an obligation for the Jews to their fellow Jews. And if you do this, God will bless you. Well, it's a sad reality that human nature requires almost that some people will fall into poverty. Somebody said, through poor judgment, wrong advice, or circumstances beyond human control, there are always people who become destitute and who must therefore cast themselves upon the merciful benevolence of others. And so that presents for us an opportunity to help those in need. And we ought to be open-handed and generous when we see a need for others. Whether it's a loan or whether it's just a gift, we ought to be willing, not stingy or grudging against those in need, but give cheerfully and generously. Somebody put it this way, in the real world of fallen humanity, there will always be the poor, but there must always be among God's people a spirit of generosity. And so I hope that we today have that spirit of generosity, especially when we see a poor person. It may be a loan, but I think even better would be simply a gift with no strings attached to say, we know that you have this need, and here's something to help you out. Especially if the Lord has blessed us abundantly, we ought to be abundantly generous. However, we do, I think, have to be discerning and be careful in some cases, because there are situations in which there's fraud or abuse and people are willing to fleece the flock, as they say. People are willing to beg or try to get money from people, and some people are warm-hearted and compassionate, and they give when really it's not in the best interest for that person to give money to that person. We don't want to enable people through our generosity to continue to make bad decisions. Just this week I got a letter from a fellow who has attended our church years ago. He's not been around here for quite a number of years. And he's a troubled individual with a troubled family, and we've tried to help them out in the past. Right now, he's in prison. He's been convicted of very serious crimes, and he'll probably be in prison for many years. We have helped the man out significantly in the past, several hundreds of dollars. We've helped this man and his family out in the past. Now he's in prison, and he's asking for more money. He wants several hundred dollars to make his existence or make his experience there in the prison more convenient and more pleasant. Well, I feel for the guy, but on the same token, he has not communicated with our church for years. Well, why is he in prison? Because our previous efforts to help him apparently did nothing to change his ways. And so we had a discussion about that with the deacons, the last deacons meeting that we had a few days ago, and we determined that we would not help him out. Now, aren't we supposed to be generous? Aren't we supposed to be open-handed? Well, yes, we are, but we have to be careful that we're not simply enabling people and using our charity to help people to do bad or to alleviate the suffering that they should expect for their bad decisions. You know, you reap what you sow. And it may be in this case that this guy needs to reap a little bit. He needs to reap some difficulties that his own decisions, the results of his own decisions. So there may be situations like that as a church that we need to be careful of. And then even in your own homes, maybe, or your extended family, you know that sometimes there are individuals who they may ask you for money or for a loan or something, and you wonder, well, what are they going to do with this? Am I enabling bad behavior to continue? Am I rewarding bad behavior? Everybody's got to make his own decision on that. You want to be open-handedly generous, And sometimes we leave it with the Lord. I've had several occasions here where somebody has asked for money, and I'm very dubious as to whether they're going to use it for good or wrong purposes. Sometimes I just say, here you go. Here's a few bucks. I don't know how you're going to use this exactly, and if you use it for ill purposes, that's between you and God. But I feel I have 20 bucks in my pocket. I can give it to you. I can be generous and not worry about what's going to happen. On the other hand, sometimes I'm much more discerning or much more concerned about how that money is going to be used. So all of us have to determine, trying to be generous, trying to be charitable, but at the same time not being foolish with the money that we have. Regarding making loans, as we're talking about here, as I said, sometimes it'd be better just to give a gift rather than making a loan. If you've ever made loans out, let's say within your family, you know that can be very difficult when the loan is not repaid. Or loans among friends, that can be very difficult if the loan is not paid on time. So it's almost best just if you have the resources to say, I'm not going to give you this as a loan, I'm going to give you this as a gift. It's hands off, it's no strings attached, you don't have to pay it back. And if this helps you out of your financial difficulty, then I'm happy to do that. So I think a gift is often better than a loan. And one last thing in this regard, if we wanted to alleviate poverty, we talked about government programs that address poverty. What would be the best way to alleviate poverty? I think it's chapter 15, verse 5. Only if you carefully obey the voice of the Lord your God to observe with care all these commandments which I command you today. If our nation would encourage people, if they would command people to follow biblical principles of money management and biblical principles, even just obeying the Ten Commandments, that would do a lot to alleviate poverty. Our nation should stand for biblical principles instead of just opening the faucet wide for every poor person who comes along. Many of them are poor because of their own bad choices. Well, we ought to teach people to obey the commandments of the Lord. And if we did that as a nation, I think that in itself would alleviate a lot of poverty. Well, the last section here, I think we'll just sort of skip over. You can read that yourselves. It talks about indentured servants and allowing them to go free, and the idea of piercing one's ear if that indentured servant wants to stay with that the person who hired them. We won't take time to go through that right now because we're kind of late as it is. But the idea here, I think the primary idea is open-handed generosity. We have the Levite, we have the orphan, the widow, we have the sojourner, we have the tithe, all these money matters. And whether we're supporting the work of the ministry through our tithes and offerings, whether we're supporting poor people in their time of need, I think the primary idea here is open-handed generosity. And perhaps some of us are struggling with that. I know from time to time I struggle with that, giving generously. Maybe we're on the edge ourselves. Maybe we're not doing so well financially. It's hard to be generous to others. Yet the Bible calls us to be open-handedly generous. And I think that that warm-hearted, as I talked about Vern Yonke, that soft-hearted generosity ought to be true of all of us. All Christians ought to have a soft-hearted generosity, especially toward those in need and especially toward fellow believers in the same church. We ought to be open. We ought to be looking for those in need that we can help. And, of course, we have the Deacon's Fund, the offering that is given in the Deacon's Fund. And if you're aware of people, especially people within the church who are needy, who have needs that the church could meet, talk to one of the deacons because we can help people in those regards. So I hope all of us will be challenged with this need to be open-handed and generous, soft-hearted and generous toward those in need. Well, let's close in prayer.